these are recollections of Turner Ashby, memories of the years when the oceans rose and the several states were separated asunder. Chapter 22. Now, I may be croaking and coughing in this reading. I gotta get that down there. I always suspected it was from that Texas winter long, long ago. So listen. They say it rarely snows in Texas. And that certainly was what one was led to believe. And what one would affirm by merely being present in that wasteland. Hot as hell in Texas. Hot enough to wring out your soul in Texas. Hot enough for all manner of evolutionarily ill conceived creatures, as scorpions would not, to seek out whatever shade or decidedly gruesome places that could scatter to. Yet on that evening when we were held at gunpoint by Harris Slaughter and his crew, who kind of reminded me of scorpions, and now you think of it, fine white flakes came floating down out of the sky, though the clouds cracked with thunder. The flakes, they hardly floated. They were more of a heavy mist, a spray of powder coming down hard and straight, sticking and accumulating just like snow, wet plastic snow. Don't put that in your mouth, honey. Claire grabbed up her young toddler boy and gently shook and swept his hands and shoulders and hooded his head to protect it. The white powder came down with just like snow. But it was not snow, it was ash, tire ash. We all looked up to the dark and undulating orange sky. We looked up like turkeys, broken and domesticated dumb turkeys, our mouths agape. One of the Slaughter boys stuck his tongue out like a kid to get a taste of the snow. I was about ready to do the same. Keep your mouths closed and your eyes shut, it'll burn, Peter Starr, our traveling doctor, advised. Oh, hell, Slaughter said. Tire Mountain's on fire again. Damn winds come up from the west, boys. We gotta get the domes over the Mungo. Now, domes over the Mungo. That sounds like a musical. Off-Broadway musical, of course. But all musicals were off-Broadway back then. Broadway was underwater. Still, domes over the Mungo. Had a nice high step and a chorus line type ring to it. Big production numbers, I am sure. Sirens sounded, and folks in the camps were pushing and running. People's chips were ringing, the chips in their heads.
Gather up all the indentures, essential, non-essential, I don't care. Get them all out there. Get them in the fields, and find out who set those fires.
Harris Slaughter, he commanded.
Move!
So just as sudden as we, well, mainly me, had been trapped by Slaughter's broad and frankly, illegitimate interpretation of the Fugitive Indenture Act of 2028, we were left to our own devices. And now when you are left to your own devices in Texas, there's only one thing to do. Leave. Words to live by, survive by.
Well, now get in the camper, get out of that stuff,
Sterling Bowen said in emotion. We all climbed in a Bowen's Winnebago camper. Let's see, now who was there? Bowen, Ed, Claire, Little Ed. I still don't know the name of that child. Lady Astoria, Peter Starr, and myself. The camper took the weight like a dump truck. Drove like one, too, but now I was getting ahead of ourselves. We all breathed in a sigh almost as one. You could feel it. You could hear the thick and crystal ash hitting the roof.
Why exactly is it snowing in Texas?
Claire asked. She was always one for clearing up the everyday mysteries of life.
The refuse mounds are on fire,
Peter Starr said.
What, like trash? How big are these mounds? Astoria asked.
Tire Mountain is the third highest peak in Texas. Then there's the appliance range. 50-mile swatch of refrigerators and washing machines stacked a half mile high, Peter said, and as he told us a story of how just about every other state's trash came to be piled up in Texas. Always well informed with Peter. This is what he had to say. back before most of the rumblings of secession. Of course, there's always been rumblings of secession in Texas, but that's just a history lesson. Well, back before the economic miracle of gold desalinating irrigation, Texas had made a healthy, well, I don't know about healthy, but a market, a trade of billions and billions of tons, translated into trillions of dollars per year, and accepting other states, other countries, waste, chemical, nuclear, metal, sanitary, plastic, paper, car parts, refrigerators, washing machines, and tires, just to name a few. They just stacked them up out there on the windy plains. They continue to do so even up to this day. Now it's good money, easy money. Money from both ends. You take it in, and you strip it down, you send the salvage back, get more money. Now, it's not devoid of people out there. There's no ghost town out there, although I imagine the ghost of my grandfather's 1964 Dodge Dart station wagon push-button automatic is wheeling around in there somewhere. I like to find it. An entire subculture, they call them, strippers, living in amongst the small and inconsistent settlements in the loose valleys between the high stacks of tires and bent metal. Some of them even live up in the mountains. It's even families up there. But it's a volatile life, lived amongst volatile wastes. And sometimes the secretions and residues and oils that don't necessarily mix meet in the dripping artificial gorges created by pressures of tons and tons of scraps and debris, and it just kind of ignites.
Well, that's all very, very nice and well, very informative, Peter, said Sterling Bowen. But what do you think? Think we can outrun that storm? Outrun the winds? Man, didn't drive to the coast. Maybe find a boat, head to Houston, head to Mexico, head somewheres out here. That's what I'm thinking. Bowen was cranking up the engine.
You could do that, but I don't think we'd make it. I propose we do the opposite. We drive right into it. Drive right through it, Peter Starr said. We drive west.
You crazy?
To minimize our exposure, we'll push against the storm, get behind the wind, get on the other side of the flames.
It was a brilliant idea, this idea of Peter Storrs. It would save us. That is how Peter Storrs saved me. And saved my dearest and only friends from drowning in the ashes of the burning Texas wasteland. It's odd in those rare, unclear moments of decision in one's life when suddenly nothing gets in the way. That is the way our traveling in the heart of the Texas wastelands was. Nothing got in the way, no checkpoints, no gates, no way station, no paperwork, no questions asked. We just drove into the smoke. That don't mean that we were on the paved glory of the interstate system of old. No, this road was a trail. And the trail was dirt and rutted and blind. You could not see where the hell you were going. Once we had crossed the lush mungo fields, we steadily went up in elevation. Could feel it. Couldn't see it. Crawling up followed a bold road around high and bright salt mounds and into thicker and thicker snow-white ash. After a number of hours, Ed got out. He tied a bandana across his face and tied a rope around his waist. And with the other end of the rope, he tied it to the bumper of the Winnebago. And basically felt his way up the narrow and steep trail, pulling. No GPS for this one, boys. We were in the wastelands, in the junk mounds and wastes of Texas, were unexplored territory. Now again, unexplored does not by no means mean unoccupied. There were people, a whole number of people sometimes, even horses and houses, well, sheds alongside the road, along the way, and there were handmade signs, carts, kids, women with children on their hips. They would slide by like ghosts out of the corner of your eye, barely seen through the driving ash outside the Winnebago's window. As we went up a hairpin turn after hairpin turn, climbing and climbing, bandana-covered faces would appear and then disappear in a half second. Who are all those people? Our little Astor.
who was not so little, no longer a child, but life. Oh, I do love that word, life, all men do. 17. We had been pushed to the rear of that RV, not being essential to the drive and all the navigation. We were ignored, so we sat back, being bounced and jolted on the floor at the foot of a bed at the back of the bus, surrounded by magic show props, posters, and paraphernalia. Sir Sterling and his Magic East Tennessee Travelers, one sign boasted. Another continued featuring Horace, the strong man. Now, I assume Horace was Ed. And the amazing and clairvoyant little lady asked story of Olivia. I didn't know you were from Bolivia, I teased. You do what you have to do. The Winnebago jumped and she slid into me. Sterling taught me how to tell fortunes. Always good to have a trade, I said. I used to own you. That's not much of a nice way to put it, I said, thinking of my internment as Lady Astoria of Lexington's personal tutor that was some years before. But I never had your heart, did I? She said with more like a 35-year-old certainty and sadness. How is she? How is Fair Liza? They say she tried to kill you. Oh, no, I said. She saved me like she saved so many others. And then I kind of became one of her projects. Oh, ladies, Fitzgerald. The Winnebago slowly moved on overnight and into morning. Though the smoke and the ash made it feel like night, a dark, starless night all the time. Toasters, microwaves, washing machines lined the side of the trail. They were the trail. We were driving on top of washing machines much of the time. A metal road banging and thumping underneath us. Odd hollow sound. We crested the ridge. We were in a pass, cutting between two high hills of broken electronics and bald tires. It was an economy up there, a trade bound to the twisted junk, leaking bearings and thousands of miles of wire. Now, I explained this fairly well in my book, The Reformation of Technology. What was like that title, The Reformation of Technology? Anyway, not much later, to our surprise, as we cut behind the tire mounds and started down a ridge of dented refrigerators, there was a bright blind in light. Claire's babe giggled. I started when she ran up front. The sun had come out. We were on the other side of the winds, the ash and the fires. The ranges of tires and smoke from millions of empty dumpsters belched like Hawaiian volcanoes all blown east. We followed a tin path up over a 4,500-foot pass, and we were safe. Relatively safe. Or at least we coughed less. We all got out and whooped it up. Oh, and we gave each other awkward hugs, and Claire took a picture with the chip in her head, probably still in her head, or maybe she transferred it to her baby. Halfway driving down the hot and dry western sloping ridge, there was a town. Proper town. Not on the map, but it's still a town. People speaking Spanish mostly, some broken English. The Winnebago came to a stop. It had run out of gas, and we stepped out into a mid-Texas-style town square surrounded by town folk. They stared. Oh, I hope they weren't going to ask us for the dates of our inoculations or our indentured transfer documents, forged and doctored as they were. Peter Story got out first. He said, "We come in peace." He gestured and he mimed. The crowd backed away.
"Really? Is that all you got? You are going to scare these natives to death."
Sterling Bowen jumped out. He had changed into a fancy baby blue tuxedo and a dusty high hat. He threw candy to the babies and the kids.
"Ladies and gentlemen," he said, "it is my most greatest pleasure to have come here directly from the tropics of East Europe, where Sir Sterling and his magic East Tennessee travels were received by the most esteemed, noble, and notable of kings and queens, and various exotic personages of any number of antiquated and modern realms. We'd like to perform a few of our most thought-provoking and generous illusions learned in the dark lands of the East." Now I talk about Virginia right there. "So may I introduce to you my most able assistant, the Princess Mary Margaret Juanita Astoria of Bolivia."
Juanita being added with the local crowd. Ah, Story appeared out of nowhere. Sheer silks and blue scarves, barefoot and haunting. I couldn't keep my eyes off of her, nor could most of the audience. But Juan did a couple card tricks and threw paper flowers in the air. Meantime, Ed, shirtless and somehow oiled, rolled out a person-sized glass box into the middle of the square. Astoria wordlessly stepped into it, closed the door. Bawan asked a number of souls to step forward and examine that glass case. The crowd pushed forward so no one could quite see what was going on. Bawan clapped his hands, the glass shattered, and Astoria was gone. Well, that was a pretty good trick. More soon, Turner Ashby.